hour, and I want to begin by summarizing what we talked about in the first hour, and those are a few things that economics is not. Some people get economics confused with history. Very easy thing to do. They think a headline such as this, "The Japan's crumbling economy enters recession," is economics, when it's really history. If you read it in the paper, it's history. It's not economics. Economics isn't mathematics. It's not psychology or ethics, nor is it common sense. And economics is not the queen of the sciences, as some economists think. And economics is not a dirty or a distasteful subject, although it may deal, as many subjects do, with things that are immoral or unethical. That doesn't make the discipline immoral or unethical. And then I summarized everything by giving you a short definition of what economics is. It's the study of the logic of choice. The study of the logic of choice. During the break, one gentleman came up to me and said he had to make a choice tomorrow night. He's either got to go to opening night of the baseball game or come to economics lectures. And he has to make a choice. And we make choices continually. We may not even be aware sometimes of our choices, but we make choices continually. And we'll be looking at the economic or the logic of making such choices. This hour and the next hour, I want to talk about the history of economic thought. Now, this is the history of secular economic thought, because really there is no Christian economics. Is something that is just developing at the end of the 20th century. So we're going to be talking a lot about a lot of men who are not Christians, but who are nevertheless very influential in the history of societies and in the history of thought. And the first one I want to talk about is Aristotle. Aristotle is easily the most influential writer or thinker in the field of economics. Aristotle was a Greek philosopher. He lived in about the 4th century BC. He was a student of Plato. And someone once said that the history of philosophy is simply footnotes to Plato. And that's not very far from the truth. And Aristotle was his brilliant student. You have there in Athens three men, Socrates, who is the teacher of Plato, and Plato, who is the teacher of Aristotle. And then Aristotle's most famous student, of course, was Alexander the Great, conqueror of the world. But there you have three thinkers who have shaped Western thought to a great deal. Aristotle proposed four ideas in the field of economics, broadly speaking. One was the barrenness or the infertility of money. Aristotle, by the way, never wrote a treatise on economics. Never wrote a book on it. But he deals with the subject, incidentally, in the Politics, for example. Plato dealt with it very incidentally in the Republic. But one of Aristotle's principal ideas was the infertility of money, the barrenness of money. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, he said money isn't like cattle. He says cattle are fertile. You can put a cow and a bull and a pen together and soon you have a calf. And cattle are fertile. They are not barren. But money, he said, is barren. Money doesn't reproduce. And he drew some interesting conclusions from that observation. A second of his ideas was the immorality of interest taking. Aristotle said that anyone who takes interest is doing something wrong. Anyone who takes interest, if you make a loan and you receive interest on that, you're doing something wrong. That was the second of Aristotle's principal ideas in economics. Thirdly, he thought that all economic value was objective. All economic value is objective. It's actually in the thing. The value of this whiteboard here is in the thing, just like its weight. That board has a weight or a mass. And its value is there too. Its value is objective. The same with this overhead projector and with everything. Value is objective. It's intrinsic. I'll use that as a synonymous word. Value is intrinsic or inherent in the object. I'm using all those words interchangeably. Objective, intrinsic, or inherent. And this is what Aristotle taught, that value is objective. And he also taught that when two people trade, when they exchange things, that the things they exchange are of equal value. The things they exchange are of equal value. Or at least they ought to be of equal value, or somebody's getting ripped off. Somebody's being defrauded. Those things ought to be of equal value. So these are Aristotle's four major ideas, and with these ideas he controlled economic thought for 2,000 years. From the time he wrote, well, some of the ideas fell at the time of the Reformation, but all of them didn't fall until the end of the 19th century. So for over 2,000 years, Aristotle was the primary economist in the world. The medieval disciple of Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, the official philosopher of the Roman Catholic Church, Thomas Aquinas, lived in the 13th century, lived in Italy. He was a disciple of Aristotle, thought very highly of Aristotle, hired a translator to translate Aristotle's works from the Arabic into Latin so that he could read them. Aristotle, of course, did not write in Arabic. He wrote in Greek. But his writings had been preserved by the Arabs, the Arab civilization. And Thomas Aquinas, who read Latin, hired a translator who translated Aristotle from Arabic into Latin so he could read Aristotle. And his great achievement in the 13th century was to try to combine, to synthesize Aristotle's philosophy and Christianity. And that synthesis became the official doctrine of the Roman Church. Well, he accepted all of Aristotle's economic ideas. Thomas did. He added one more, which really is not a new idea. It simply follows from what Aristotle had taught, and that is the notion of a just price or a just wage. He adds these ideas, the just price and the just wage. And you'll find these ideas, these are not medieval ideas only. You'll find them in the official statements issued by the Vatican in the 20th century. They continue to refer to just prices and just wages. These are not ideas that were developed 700 or 2,000 years ago and are no longer current. They are in circulation and are the official doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, let me give you a quote from Aristotle to give you some idea of what he wrote. He says, he distinguishes between two sorts of money-making. And he says, of the two sorts of money-making, this is Aristotle, one, as I have just said, is a part of household management. Remember how I talked about to the Greeks economics with household management? The other is retail trade. The former necessary and honorable, household management is necessary and honorable. The latter, retail trade, is a kind of exchange which is justly censured. Justly condemned. For it is unnatural and a mode by which men gain from one another. the most hated sort and with the greatest reason is usury. Usury, an unusual word that we don't hear much today, usury, which makes a gain out of money itself and not from the natural use of it. Many states used to have usury laws on the books. Perhaps some still do. They said it's illegal for anyone to take more than 10% interest. I remember when we bought a house in Maryland back in 1979, I guess it was. We had to buy in Maryland because the state we wanted to live in had a usury law which said it's illegal to pay or to accept more than 8% interest. Consequently, no one was lending any money in that state. In Maryland, they had a higher usury law. It was 12% or something like that. And the law had not shut down the lending industries in the state of Maryland. Now, usury laws in the Middle Ages were intended to do just that, to shut down lending. Because the Roman Church, which controlled society during the Middle Ages, adopted Aristotle's view that the taking of interest is immoral. The taking of interest is wrong. Well, Aristotle, to continue with the quote, he says, money was intended to be used in exchange, but not to increase in interest. And this term usury, which means the birth of money from money, is applied to the breeding of money while the offspring resembles the parent. Wherefore, of all modes of making money, this is the most unnatural. This is unnatural. It's not like household management, he says, which is honorable. Retail trade is unnatural, and to be condemned. Well, 1,500 years after Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas wrote, it's altogether sinful to have recourse to deceit in order to sell a thing for more than its just price, because this is to deceive one's neighbor so as to injure him. He wrote further, whatever is established for the common advantage should not be more of a burden to one party than to another, and consequently all contracts between them should observe equality of thing and thing. Therefore, if either the price exceed the quantity of the thing's worth, or conversely the thing exceed the price, there is no longer the equality of justice, and consequently to sell a thing for more than it's worth or to buy it for less than it's worth is itself unjust and unlawful. And then Aquinas condemned usury, or the taking of interest himself, says to take usury for money lent is unjust in itself, because this is to sell what does not exist. And these quotes I'm giving you are from his most famous book, the Summa Theologica. Now, as I say, these ideas controlled economic thinking for 2,000 years. Aristotle, the originator, and Thomas Aquinas, his most influential disciple. They became the official teaching of the Roman Church. They remain the official teaching of the Roman Church. And every one of them is wrong. Every one of them is wrong. What happens in the 16th century? You have the Reformation. And you have here a break with Aristotle and with the Roman Catholic Church. And that break affects economic thinking. We're not talking about just the influence in society, but if you read the little pamphlet, Civilization and the Protestant Reformation, you'll see some of the discussion of the economic consequences of the Reformation there in society. But in theory, there's a break with Aristotle. In theory, there's a break with Aristotle. Martin Luther's contribution to economic theory was inadvertent. Inadvertent. And nevertheless, it's very profound. Now, Martin Luther did not attack any of these Aristotelian ideas specifically. He didn't attack the immorality of interest taking. He didn't attack the idea of the infertility of money. He didn't attack objective value, and he did not attack equality in exchange. What does Martin Luther do, though? He talks about work. He talks about good works. This is central to the issue of justification in theology. In Catholic theology, good works are important. They get us into heaven. And some works are better than others. If you're a religious person, if you're a monk, or if you're a nun, if you're in a convent, if you're a priest, if you're a religious, and the Catholic folks will just end the statement there, if you are a religious, you're not leaving out the noun, that's the way the language is used by Catholics. If you are a religious, then you're doing works that are acceptable to God. If you are not a religious, if you're an ordinary person, if you're a farmer, a homemaker, a blacksmith, a milkmaid, whatever it might be, then you are not doing these good works. You're not participating in the singing. You're not participating in the life of the convent. You're not participating in the saying of the rosary at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're not doing any of these things. Well, Luther came along and he said, justification is by faith alone. It's not by any of these religious works that people are doing. And he says the activities of a farmer or a milkmaid or a parent or a mother or whoever, their actions are as good as or better than the work of any religious person. And his teaching on good works, read his commentary on Galatians sometime, his teaching on works, his good works, and the role of works in theology revolutionized the society of Europe. 300 years later, another German named, and I'll give you the English pronunciation, it's Max Weber in English, M-A-X-W-E-B-E-R, wrote a book called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, in which he discusses the impact of Luther's view of work, among other things, on economic development. He wrote the book because historians had noticed something very odd about the economic development of the Western world, and that is that the Protestant countries developed, and the Catholic countries stagnated. So you see in Northwestern Europe, you see development occurring in Germany, in Holland, in England, preeminently in the United States. You see this tremendous economic development in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. But countries that are not Protestant are stagnating. Southern Europe, Latin America, and they remain behind today. They still remain behind. But the economic development occurred along theological lines. And Weber was not the first, but he was perhaps the most famous of the writers of the early 20th century. Weber, the English pronunciation, Weber, the German. He wrote a book trying to explain why capitalism, why free enterprise, emerged in the pattern that it did. Very interesting book. You should read it sometime. He makes some theological mistakes in it, but it still makes very interesting reading about the development of free enterprise, the development of capitalism. Luther, his revolution was in the area of work and the dignity of work, ordinary work. He says, if you're a farmer and a Christian, and you perform your duties because you want to obey God, and you do it out of gratitude, he said, you're doing something that is more pleasing to God than all the monks and the nuns and all the monasteries and convents in the world. I once heard a story about a Catholic gentleman who was more Protestant than he realized. His son became a monk. And he was very proud of his son who had joined the monastery. And he got a letter from his son once, and the letter reported to his father. The son reported that, I get up every 2 hours during the night, and I say my prayers, and I count the rosary, and I do my other religious exercises. And there's a note of condescension here, because, of course, his father wasn't doing these things. His father was just an ordinary, common working man raising a family. And the father, in his wisdom, wrote back to his son, the monk, and he said, that's very, very good, son. Well, we're glad you're doing that. And we want you to know that when you and your brothers and sisters were growing up, your mother and I got up every 2 hours. And we tended to the needs of little children, and we prayed for them. And what we did is as good as what you're doing in the monastery. The father was not to be put down by the proud spirit of his son, the monk. Being more Protestant than he knew, he realized that what he had done as a parent in raising his children was of more value, more theological value, than what his son was doing in the monastery. Well, it's not until Luther's disciple, John Calvin, appears on the scene. And keep in mind that there's 25 years difference between Luther and Calvin. People sometimes forget that. Calvin was the younger of the two. Calvin directly challenges the idea that money is infertile and that all interest taking is wrong. He directly challenges those ideas that were set forth by Aristotle and adopted by Thomas Aquinas and the Roman Church. And Calvin, in explaining the meaning of the Old Testament and the New Testament, in writing his commentaries and his sermons, he said, there are two situations in which people can take interest on loans. Because one is a business situation, and one is a charitable situation. And he says, yes, it's true that if you lend money as an act of charity to a poor man, then you ought not accept any interest on this charitable loan. And to do so would be wrong. To do so would be sin. Because it's an act of charity. To expect back more than you have lent would be wrong. It's an act of charity. But, he said, in the matter of business loans, where they are not acts of charity, where you're lending money to someone to establish a business, to operate a business, to open up a new business, this is not an act of charity. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with taking interest in this case. And he directly denies Aristotle's teaching on the wrongfulness of usury, the wrongfulness of taking interest. This contributes, along with Luther's the change in the idea of work, to the economic development of the West, particularly the Protestant countries. Calvin's explicit attack on Aristotle in that regard. Looking at some of the Puritans, Richard Baxter and John Bunyan, they wrote about what might be called economic matters, but they're more concerned with ethics than with economics, and they didn't develop their thought in any systematic way. But Luther and Calvin had laid the ground for some further progress in economic theory. Later in the modern world. Well, let's skip over to about the last half of the 16th century, the beginning of the 17th century. And a body of thought begins to develop at that time in the 17th century, late 16th century, called mercantilism. Mercantilism. The mercantilist, well, let's talk about the word for a moment. It's mercantilists is the mercantilist. Mercantilism is ISM, obviously. Has anybody watched Little House on the Prairie here? What do they call the general store? The mercantile. That was the old word for what we call a store. It was the mercantile. Mercantilism was the idea that one of the functions of government is to aid in the economic development of the business enterprises, to aid the merchants. And their doctrine was specifically boiled down to the idea that money is good, gold and silver are wealth, and things that contribute to the accumulation of wealth, meaning gold and silver, are policies that ought to be encouraged. And everything ought to be done in the national interest. So it was a nationalist idea. And this is the thinking that controlled the age and the development of nation states in Europe and the explorations of the New World. This mercantilism. It resulted in some very interesting policies, which again are still with us in the 20th century, at the end of the 20th century. Mercantilism, since it believed that wealth consisted of gold and silver, said we need to aid the merchants who are exporting things, because when they export things, the gold and the silver come into our country. And gold and silver are wealth, and we all become richer. However, we need to discourage merchants who are importing things. Because when we import things, we have to pay out gold and silver, and we become poorer. Exports are good, imports are bad in mercantilism. And you see the same idea present at the end of the 20th century. Of course, the people that hold the idea don't call themselves mercantilists anymore. But you see the same concern. We shouldn't be importing so many things from Japan or wherever. We ought to be exporting more things. We have a trade deficit. And if you pick up the newspapers, you'll see this all over the place. We have a trade deficit with Japan. You never hear about the trade deficit with Canada for some reason, but we always have a trade deficit with Japan or a trade deficit with China or whatever the case might be, Korea, Indonesia. We have all these trade deficits. That is, we're importing more from them than we are exporting. And going back to our mercantilist roots, imports are bad. And exports are good. So what we need, and you find this in a lot of policy discussion today, what, 300 years after this body of theory developed, policies, how can we encourage exports? How can we discourage imports? And you see all sorts of recommendations for doing those things. The mercantilists, of course, said, use tariff. And people today say, use tariff. Tariffs are taxes on goods being imported. So they will tend to stop things from being imported. They're taxes imposed at the border on goods coming into a country. Subsidize exporters. So, under this type of thought, in the 1930s, the government set up the Export-Import Bank for the purpose of subsidizing exports in the Roosevelt administration. And today we have all sorts of trade, international trade policies designed to do these very two things. Encourage exports, discourage imports. We're still laboring under the influence of mercantilism. Again, this is not an idea that was popular 300 years ago and then disappeared. It's just changed its name, but it's still around and still very influential. Perhaps the most famous book in the history of economics was written against mercantilism, the doctrines of mercantilism. Who wants to take a guess at what that book is? Yes, sir. The Wealth of Nations. Who's the author? Adam Smith. And John Smith did a lot of things, but he didn't write The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith, a Scots philosopher. He was professor of moral theology. He was not an economist. There was no one in a college in the U.S. called an economist until the end of the 19th century. He was a moral philosopher. He wrote a book called An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. 1776, he published it that year so Americans would always remember when the book was published. That was a joke. And it is usually regarded as the first book on economics in the history of the discipline. In fact, Smith is sometimes called the father of economics. And he wanted to write the book to defend free trade, free international trade across borders, and to attack mercantilism, the idea that exports are good and imports are bad. And he did it very ably in that book. Smith was an empiricist in economics. Smith was an empiricist. Just like in philosophy, the economists break down into two broad categories. One was empiricist and one is rationalist. And he's an empiricist. And he includes a great deal of history and a great deal of observation in his book on the Wealth of Nations. But he's always endeavoring to undercut empiricism. He becomes the founder of what's called the classical school of economics. Smith is really the first of the classical economists. Now, how did Smith define economics? Economics is for Smith the science of wealth and welfare. The science of wealth and welfare. And here's an exact quote from Smith. Political economy, which is the old word for economics, political economy proposes to enrich both the people and the sovereign. Both the people and the sovereign. Now, about the time, in fact, a little bit before Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, there was another gentleman named Bernard Mandeville who wrote a book called The Fable of the Bees. The Fable of the Bees, in which he argued that private vices, private sins lead to public good. Private vices lead to public good. Smith didn't quite say it like that, but he did say that people acting in their own self-interest, are led as if by an invisible hand to carry out a purpose which they do not intend. And that's where we get the phrase, the invisible hand. It's from Adam Smith. People acting in their own self-interest are led as if by an invisible hand to carry out a purpose which they don't intend. So if you hear the phrase, the invisible hand, you know where it came from. It's Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations. This is the idea of unintended consequences becomes a very influential idea in the later development of economic thought. Well, a second thinker in the classical school is David Ricardo. David Ricardo, despite his name, he's an Englishman. No relation to Ricky Ricardo, to my knowledge. And he follows Smith in writing. He writes at the beginning of the 19th century. And he develops the theory of comparative advantage, and we'll talk about that later as well, the theory of comparative advantage. And he believed that economics concerns only the distribution and not the production of wealth. Smith taught that it was an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations, and Ricardo says the big issue is the distribution of wealth, not the production of wealth. And he also was a classical economist. Later on, you find men like James Mill, the Scots philosopher James Mill, and his son John Stuart Mill, a very influential English philosopher in the middle of the century, also writing about economics, and they're members of the classical school. John Stuart Mill becomes a socialist late in life. And studying his thought is a very interesting, fascinating study, because he starts out as an advocate of free enterprise and ends up as a socialist. Well, you have also writing about that time, the historian, the English historian, Carlyle, Thomas Carlyle. He has nothing but contempt for economics. He calls it pig science. Pig science. I suppose that might insult some veterinarians, but he thought economics was pig science. Then you have, moving into the 20th century, a gentleman by the name of Lionel Robbins, an Englishman, Lionel, like the train, last name is Robbins. He comes closer to an accurate definition of economics. Economics is the science which studies human behavior as a relationship between ends and scarce means, which have alternative uses. The science which studies human behavior as a relationship between ends and scarce means, which have alternative uses. The major school of economic thought in the 20th century is the neoclassical school, which developed at Cambridge University in England. And they self-consciously went back to Smith, they went back to Ricardo, and tried to recover some of their insights and to develop them further. But economics, beginning in the 18th century, probably beginning earlier than that, but in the 18th century, you have the development of a number of different economic points of view, economic philosophy. And I'm going to open it up for any questions that I might have raised in this first 45 minutes here. And before I get into the scattering of views in the 19th century and 20th century. Are there any questions so far? Have I muddled things up, or do you need anything clarified about Aristotle or the Reformation? Yes, sir. I don't know that there was an occasion. He was just concerned to defeat the arguments of the mercantilists, who had controlled policymaking by the kings of Europe for at least 100 years. And he was convinced that free trade would benefit the nations, the peoples, better than a policy of mercantilism. And that was the reason he wrote it, but I don't know that there was any specific occasion for it. Moral theology, University of Glasgow. As I say, there was no developed science of economics at that point. And for 100 years, those who taught any economics were moral theologians or moral philosophers. It was regarded as part of the Department of Philosophy or the Department of Theology. And it was developing in its infancy. I would argue that it actually didn't start with Smith even. The discipline of economics is only a little over 100 years old. But we'll get into that in the next hour. Yes? Yes. Defense of free trade. Any other questions? Yes, sir. No tariff? It means no tariff in the sense that no barrier tariff. They would allow tariffs only in the sense of a revenue tariff. And I ought to distinguish between those two. If the purpose of levying a tariff, which is a tax, keep in mind, imposed at the border on goods coming into a country, if the purpose of that is to raise revenue for maintaining the functions of government, then you're going to want to set the tariff at the rate in which you'll receive the most revenue. That is, you will not set it prohibitively high or you won't get the revenue. It will simply stop the goods from coming into the country. So a revenue tariff was not argued against by the classical economists like Smith. What they argued against were prohibitive tariffs. That is, tariffs intended to stop imports from coming into the country. Those would be tariffs that are so high that the importation of the goods would simply stop. And obviously, the purposes of the tariffs and the results of the two kinds of tariffs are opposite. One is to raise revenue, the maximum amount. The other is to stop the goods. So depending on where you impose the tax, how much tax you impose, you're going to get one effect or the other. They're both involve the use of taxes, but for completely different purposes. Yes, sir? A connection between tariffs and war. Well, classical economists certainly argued that there was. In fact, one of the sayings that came out of the classical school was that when goods cannot cross borders, armies will. And they argued from history that if prohibitive tariffs are put in place, then that leads to an escalating conflict, which may begin in economic policy between nations, but it soon ends up in battlefields. And they argued that point from history as well.